talk, as I sometimes do, to regular folk about the paradigm shift from a machine or reductionist worldview to one more holistic, and you're asking for blank stares. Yet give examples of how the shift to holism affects their lives, like in healthcare, and a growing minority, if not a majority of Americans, recognizes holistic approaches with the emphasis on prevention are the cheapest and wisest ways to approach issues. Yet, as we know from our own lives, getting from awareness to action is often a tough step. That is where food comes in, say the authors of a new book. Food is the pathway to our senses. Food is the way through all our preconceptions. Via food, we recognize each other as human beings. And in a culture dominated by the view of machines as man's highest achievement, seeing people as human beings and not consumers is critical. Address food issues and you peel the proverbial onion and find how capitalism and democracy must change and are being reinvented to serve both people and the planet better. The co-authors I speak of are a mother and daughter team. Frances Moore LaPaye is the author of The Groundbreaking Diet for a Small Planet 30 years ago and more than a dozen other books. Her daughter Anna LaPaye holds an MA from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and is the co-founder with her mom of the Small Planet Fund. The new book is Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet. A pleasure to bring you both here on the program.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. This is exciting. This book has answered some questions for me, and I do a lot of these interviews.
That's good to hear.
So it really has, and hopefully we'll get into some of that. You know, at first glance, from what I understand about you two, you would seem an unlikely pair to write a book about food issues when, Frances, you struggled with weight problems, and Anna, your idea of a home-cooked meal was once hummus and pita. So can you tell us about how you've made a transformation in your own lives to start working on food?
Well, I think 30 years ago, when I was my daughter's age, I, like so many people, so many women, just was never satisfied with my weight, was always counting calories, felt imprisoned by this preoccupation. And then I discovered the world of plant foods. And I was dazzled. It was like falling in love with all these colors and shapes and tastes and textures and all these combinations of the plant world, you know, because I had grown up on, you know, meatloaf and fried potatoes. And so it was discovery. It wasn't, oh, I'm going to do the right thing and sort of constrict myself. It was discovery. And when I started eating whole foods, plant foods, the extra pounds just melted away. I never dieted. And I've stayed the same weight since I was 26.
A rather fit figure, I must say.
So it worked. Yeah. And it was rather than being a pain, it was a joy.
And Anna, we go to your house, you have the hummus, I bring the pita, and that's a good meal.
Well, I think it's changed a little bit, I'm glad to say. I think people had this image of me, anybody who knows of my mom's work, I think people had this image that the daughter of the author of Diet for a Small Planet must be this kitchen aficionado. And actually, as soon as I left home, I think I became a very typical American. I got to college and I felt I never had the time, I never had the money to cook what I knew we should be eating. I knew what my body wanted, but I just never prioritized it. I always felt like I never had the time. And actually, through writing this book and through traveling to the five continents that we traveled to and meeting the people that we met and eating their home-cooked meals, often fresh from their kitchen gardens or their farms, really brought me actually in touch with the kind of food that has felt great to be eating and the kinds of traditional diets of whole foods and the kinds of diets that my mom has been promoting for 30 years, but that was always hard on my own as a young woman to make for myself.
And yet you start your travels and the first bit of synchronicity happens when you find out the Sanskrit word for food.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, I was saying to my mom, no one's going to believe us when we say what happened, which was actually we were traveling from southern India. We're on a plane from southern India to Delhi, and we were going to Delhi to meet with a farmers network that's reclaiming traditional Indian foods and traditional farming practices. And we pulled out a book on Indian food traditions, and we both read at the same time that the Sanskrit word for food is Anna.
So this means that after Diet for a Small Planet and before I wrote Food First, I named my baby daughter Food. And so that was it. I had never known that before. And so we kind of laughed and said, nobody's going to believe this one.
Yeah, well, no, those are people who do believe in synchronicity. And what's the word? There's a quote that says, Coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. Quote, right? So now 30 years, now a lot of it has changed in 30 years, but 30 years after the book, Diet for a Small Planet, Francis, you still find yourself battling the notion that world hunger is based on the false notion of scarcity. Explain that.
Absolutely. Well, things have changed, yes. Things have gotten much worse, and also things have gotten so much better in ways I could never have predicted 30 years ago. This is the paradoxical world in which we live. And certainly the way things have remained the same or gotten worse is that this myth that the fundamental problem is scarcity, and if we just narrow our focus down to produce more, and if we just go for the latest technology, now genetically modified organisms, then the world can be fed, is the myth, and that's still being foisted on us, when in fact there is more than enough food right now to make us all chubby. It's just that now close to half of the world's grain is going into livestock, who we've turned into protein disposal systems.
Yeah, we're feeding the middle cow.
Yeah.
It's not the middleman, it's the middle cow, right? and you talk about in the book how you talk about scarcity in the United States. We lead the world in efficiency, wasting 90% of our resources.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that. That's an interesting quote.
Yes. Well, this struck me because I had always just focused on food, but you broaden out and you see the same pattern in all of our production of things that actually, out of all that is consumed in producing all of our commodities, all of our consumer goods, only 10% of it is actually returned to us in something we can actually
Something use. Tangible.
Something tangible. And the rest is all waste. And of course, all of this is what is creating the environmental devastation, which means that the very base of our security is being undercut. So it's like we're eroding our foundation. We're mining our foundation to build a house, which makes no sense whatsoever. And so we think that food is the place to start to really get in touch with our common sense, with our innate human sensibilities for what is viable for us all.
And yet you didn't recognize that right away. You were working on a different project, an alternative news network, and that kind of crashed, and you didn't know what to do. And
My kids saved me. Isn't this wonderful that we give birth to these creatures and they come around and give us new hope? And so my son, Anthony, and my daughter, Anna, sat me down actually in a bar in Lower Manhattan, and they said, Mom, you've got to go back to your original instinct 30 years ago. Follow the food. That's what our generation needs this, and we'll help you. That's what they said.
How did you know that?
Well, I think we knew that. We had seen what had happened. You mentioned the American News Service. We had seen this trajectory of our mom's thinking and work life, and we'd seen what she was able to create with the American News Service that was actually around for about 5 years. And we felt that there was this moment in her life, the 30th anniversary of Diet for a Small Planet was almost upon us, and we felt that it was a moment in her life to be able to go back 30 years to her original intuition about food, but also take what she'd learned in those 30 years, including, I think, one of the most important lessons of the American News Service, which was a service that was trying to create a mainstream newswire like AP, but that would focus entirely on covering what they called America's Search for Solutions. Stories not just of the third grader who saved 100 pennies and donated it to the local food bank, but real stories of people solving problems together in communities on a whole range of different issues. And so she had seen these amazing stories that were out there, but that we were not hearing. And so we felt that she had learned this very powerful lesson of the power that positive stories, and not just cheesy, flaky positive stories, but real stories of real struggle. She'd seen the power that those stories could have, and we felt that she could combine that sense of the power of the story with her understanding of the power of food. And that is what became Hope's Edge.
Amen. Or should I say bon appetit? We're chatting with Francis Moore LaPay and Anna LaPay. They are the co-authors of Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet. I'm Paul Nelson. Well, let's look at some of the main developments in that 30-year period. CEO pay has skyrocketed over the pay of the lowest paid employees that work for the same corporations. And you mentioned it, the advent of genetically engineered foods, or GMO, genetically modified organisms, which I think is extremely pernicious. And it's amazing how, well, it's a symptom of what situation we find ourselves in with pretty much the corporations running the government. So can you talk about those two issues?
Well, I think that the GMO, the genetically modified organisms, what few Americans understand is that because this has moved ahead with government, our government support, and corporate pushing it through without citizen input, that this is an example, this is such a sign of the limits of our democracy, and that we have become the world's guinea pigs. We Americans are the world's guinea pigs. Most genetically modified organisms, these seeds, are planted here in the U.S. It's so different, for example, when we were in France. In France, citizens were involved in a national debate about whether they wanted genetically modified organisms. And there was a body created by a government institution called the Council of State that drew citizens together to be well-informed and debate the risks and benefits of genetically modified organisms. And these citizens said, no, we don't want this. But here in this country, we haven't had that opportunity. So for us, the GMO, the genetically modified organism intrusion into our food supply, is a symptom of the silencing of us as citizens.
There's a great quote in the book about Monsanto, and I made a note about that, but maybe you can beat me to it and tell us a little bit about the company that's driving this whole push towards GMOs. And there it is, page 27. But go ahead, if you remember, go ahead. Otherwise, I'll go right to it.
Go right to it.
Or Anna, if you understand that.
Well, on a very personal note, my family had a very personal brush with Monsanto, and I think it became, for me, an example of the limits of what kind of information we're hearing. My dad is a scientist and an author, and he wrote about 4 years ago a book called Against the Grain, Biotechnology and the Corporate Takeover of Our Food. And it was his attempt just to do a very straightforward scientific analysis looking at Monsanto's claims about their products, which I remember at the time seemed like, well, that makes a lot of sense. These are new. This is a whole new development. Let's look scientifically at the claims and at what the results are. And his book was... the conclusion was basically that Monsanto had inflated their claims about the kinds of yields you could get with Monsanto's products. And his book was actually at a New York City publisher's, at the printers, when his publisher got a letter from a Monsanto lawyer threatening them, saying, you could go ahead and publish this book, but just be forewarned, you may be hearing from me shortly after. And his publisher actually said, sorry, Mark, we can't afford to take that risk.
And this is what happens when you have this degree of concentration of power. I think what you're referring to there in the book is that roughly 85% of the seeds that are genetically modified are under the control of Monsanto, and they also control the techniques that are used by genetic manipulators. So they have another level of control as well in terms of patents on the actual scientific technique. So it's the concentration of control breeds this kind of audacity of going in and threatening to shut up a publisher.
Free speech ends with a guy who signs your checks, is what my friend Brian Love says. And Monsanto, for those who don't know, you say in the book, and it's the clearest summary of this company, it's a company that helped develop the atom bomb, produced cancer-causing PCBs, brought to us the dioxin-containing herbicides used in Agent Orange, which we used to defoliate Vietnam and are still seeing the effects of with Vietnam vets. And you talked about Against the Grain, so that was the last part of that quote.
And I would just like to add, one of the things we talk about in the book are these thought traps, these ways that we're kind of trapped into thinking certain ways. And one of those thought traps is the thought trap of the expert. And I think I've talked to a lot of people my age who say, you know, I just don't know how to make sense of all of this, the science out there about genetically modified foods, and I'm not an expert. These people must know something I don't know. And what I think is really important that we try to talk about is that you don't have to be an expert to be able to be skeptical of a company that's trying to shut a publisher up, or skeptical of a company that puts millions of dollars into a group called the Council on Biotechnology, which sounds like a neutral-sounding organization, but actually is funded by 7 or 8 of the biggest biotech companies to sway public opinion.
Scarcity was one of those thought traps, too, which we discussed, that false notion of scarcity. Could you talk about some of the other thought traps, the free market being the answer to all our problems?
Well, I think that there's a cluster here that we call the second and third thought trap. Second one being is that we are simply, human beings can be reduced to this notion of a selfish accumulator. We're just selfish little shoppers. That's all we are. And once we start thinking of ourselves that way, then of course we're going to believe that, well, if that's who we are, then we should just leave all outcomes to the market, whatever the market decides. If people go hungry, too bad. If people can't afford a house, too bad. Because any other alternative would require something from us, which these selfish little shoppers are incapable of doing. So there's a combination here of this notion of our very limited caricature of ourselves that then has to turn over outcomes to the market. So we call it, taking off from financier George Soros, we call it market fundamentalism, this rigid notion, which then the irony is it leads to somebody like Paul O'Neill looking at the Enron debacle.
Paul O'Neill is our Secretary of Treasury,
and calling it the genius of capitalism. I mean, once you're locked into this narrow view that whatever happens in the quote-unquote free market is good, then your whole thinking gets distorted. So we ask people to really look at themselves and say, do you really think that you are simply a selfish little accumulator? Rather, I think most people see in themselves much deeper needs, the needs for communities that work, that real connections with others, and a need to feel that, yes, our lives do have impact beyond our immediate survival. And that's what we found everywhere we went on five continents. People, part of the solutions, who were really laughing at this caricature of themselves and listening to these deeper needs.
Yeah, it's funny maybe at first, but then when you think about it, it really goes to the core of our self-esteem, and it's really pernicious. And it's strengthened by the media, which, if you're going to talk about what's happened in the last 30 years, we can talk about the deregulation of broadcasting, which has forced a lot of small broadcasters out, a lot of minority broadcasters, women broadcasters out. The owners of radio stations in terms of minorities and women has plummeted in the era of deregulation, which is really the last 30 years. And one of the ways that people are dealing with this in other countries, in Brazil, is through small-powered independent radio stations. We see a similar movement here with micropower and low-power FM, which was fought by the NAB and by NPR. But tell us about that group in Brazil and how they are solving one of those problems, and that is the monopoly on information.
Well, there are two stories in Brazil that were so interesting. One, I think you're what you're referring to, the fourth largest city in Brazil is called Belo Horizonte, which translates as Beautiful Horizon. And in 1993, the municipal government said, wait a minute, food is essential to life. Food is more basic than being a consumer. I mean, if you can't afford food in the marketplace, you're still a human being who deserves to eat. And so since we, the local government, are responsible to every citizen, no matter what their wealth status is, then we have to make sure food is available to everyone. And that then, they said, okay, how can we make the market work? And back to information. So they said, hey, why don't we make sure that prices of basic foods are posted in bus stops and listed over the radio and by telephone so that you can call and find out and do comparison shopping. So if you're living in a poor neighborhood and the prices are, you're getting price gouged up, that you can get this information and call your call to account the local food seller. So this is the kind of intervention that came forth once the city government said, wait a minute, food should be a right of membership in the human community, a right of citizenship. And all sorts of other things came forward as well.
Which is an amazing thing, food being a right of citizenship. And you think that as the most powerful and the richest democracy in the world, we would have this, but then people put it down by saying that's socialism or whatever. And then we see about one out of five kids in this country starving.
Yes.
And what I think was so interesting about the city that my mom was describing is that it wasn't socialism. It wasn't about getting rid of the market. It was about making the market work. And it was interesting for me. I had just been a graduate student studying economics, studying the basic rules of how to make the market work. And all the principles of how a market should work are almost all of them are often violated in how the market functions day to day in many of our, for instance, major cities. And so to see the city in Brazil that was saying, look, we're not trying to get rid of the market. We're trying to make sure that if there are flaws in the market, for instance, not full information and other things happening in the market that are making it so the average person isn't able to afford to feed themselves, the government has to step in we have that duty.
Yeah. And a group in Brazil, the MST, actually has small powered radio stations. And so they're affecting information that way.
Yes. This is the largest social movement in this hemisphere that has grown up in the last 20 years. And this in a country that has suppressed any movement like this with violence over decades. And now this movement has settled 250,000 families on formerly idle land, 15 million acres, and they've created communities and, yes, low-power radio so that they can reach out and tell potential members of their movement what is available to them. They have used a constitutional clause which requires the government to redistribute idle land to the landless, and they've created small farms and cooperatives and businesses. They're growing the first organic seed line in Brazil. They've created schools for their children, and these are all people with a fifth-grade education. It really opened us up to what people are capable of once they work together and start listening to their deeper values.
And it also was a great lesson for both of us about how the media, especially a very corporate controlled, concentrated controlled media, can really affect public opinion. When we arrived in Brazil, the newspaper articles we read about this movement described them as literally as kidnappers, as extremists, as revolutionaries, as radicals, painted this very dark picture of what these people were doing. But actually going out and meeting members of this movement, what we saw is that they weren't these violent criminals. They were actually using what in America, what we would call civil disobedience, to basically get the government to live up to a promise that they made in the Constitution. And one of the most interesting things was our translator was a middle-class Brazilian who had gotten his information about the MST from the Brazilian newspapers. And so he arrived and he was really curious to meet these people himself, because he had these images of these real rabid crazies, and it was great to watch his own education. And by the end, he had taken down all of their numbers, and he was going to keep in touch with all of these landless worker movement members, and we've been in touch with him, and he has stayed in touch with them. And so we got to see how when a typical Brazilian actually got to meet the people and got to bypass the media story, how it changed his whole opinion. And one of the things that the MST people told us is that they saw how they were being represented in the media, and they knew that they better do something about it. So they started their own community radio stations, and they started getting people to go out into the cities and actually tell Brazilians themselves about what the MST is really about.
Their version of hiring a PR firm, I suppose. So we're out of time for this segment. Can you give us the best website to find more information about your work?
Sure, thanks. The website for the book is www.dietforasmallplanet.com.
There you have it. And we'll have a link on our website at nperia.org. Talking with Francis Moore LaPe and Anna LaPe, that's the book, Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet.